Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
President Donald Trump approved today the declassification of a secret Republican memo on the Russia inquiry. The House Intelligence Committee has released it, and the memo alleges surveillance abuses in the FBI's Russia investigation. The FBI Agents Association is responding today in a tweet saying, quote, "The American people should know that they continue to be well served by the world's preeminent law enforcement agency. FBI special agents have not and will not allow partisan politics to distract us from our solemn commitment to our mission," end quote. Well, joining us now with more is NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Hi there, Phil.
Thanks for having me.
So let me ask you first, tell us more about what are the particular claims made in the memo.
Well, this is part of a strategy by Republicans to raise doubts among their own supporters, at least, about whatever might issue from the work being done by Justice Department Special Counsel Robert Mueller in the FBI and the Justice Department. And so as part of that strategy, the Nunes memo is a series of points prepared by him and his Republican majority on the House Intelligence Committee that makes the case that there was a lot of partisan animus inside the FBI and Justice in 2016, that they relied on unverified evidence from the infamous Russia dossier when asking to do surveillance on a Trump campaign advisor, Carter Page, and that this whole origin of the Russia investigation, or at least this part of it, is because of a conspiracy, in their view, between people in the deep state and the Clinton campaign. There are some other interesting points about the memo, but that's what Republicans want to be the takeaway, and that's why they brought about its release today.
Okay. So about those other interesting points, though, the memo does say, kind of buried in the middle of it, that there was no link between Carter Page, the Trump advisor who you mentioned before, and fellow Trump campaign associate George Papadopoulos. There are some people in the national security establishment who are saying that that's an important part of the memo.
It is important. What the memo says is that the FBI's counterintelligence investigation looking into whether there were ties between the Trump campaign and the Russian attack on the 2016 election came about because of the George Papadopoulos story. He was another junior advisor who got importuned by Russians very soon after joining the campaign. They offered him dirt on Hillary Clinton. They offered him off-the-record meetings with Russians and Trump people. And he allegedly, reportedly, got drunk about it with an Australian diplomat in London and told him about all this. And this Australian told his government, which told the United States, and that's what got the probe rolling. So that story's been reported before, but what hasn't been confirmed in this way, because we very seldom get to see these kinds of classified materials, is that that is the actual origin of the Russia investigation. This Papadopoulos story came in the door to the FBI, the State Department, and they began the probe for that reason, as opposed to the Steele dossier or any other potential contact that might have taken place between Americans and Russians.
And some of the president's staunchest defenders have been saying that it's the Steele dossier that kicked off the investigation, though, right? I mean, is that why this seems to be a kind of important line?
That's correct. So the question is, what got this rolling? And did it get rolling because of this unverified material or something else? The answer is something else, although the Nunes memo makes the case that that unverified material was part of evidence the FBI and Justice gave to do this surveillance. In their view, that was against the rules because the material is unproven. Democrats say that this memo doesn't tell the whole story, so we don't have any way of knowing in their telling, for example, what other evidence might have been in the FBI or Justice Department brief they gave to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court.
Right. Okay. So there's a Democratic rebuttal, and do we know if and when that's going to come out?
We know that committee members want it to come out. The House Speaker, Paul Ryan, has said he thinks it should come out, too, and that Democrats should get their chance to rebut this charge or these charges made by Nunes in their memo. We don't know when that's going to happen yet. We don't know if it's going to come out today or whether it might take some more review or declassification before it actually becomes public. So for now, the Nunes memo will stand alone in all the coverage in the discussion.
Phil Ewing, NPR National Security Editor. Thanks so much, Phil.
Thank you.
Well, for more on the memo and the potential political fallout of its release, we spoke earlier with Brian Bennett, White House reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and Abby Phillip, White House correspondent for CNN. And we started by asking Brian his thoughts about President Trump's decision to have the memo declassified.
Yeah, one thing that's really fascinating about this is how President Trump is ignoring advice from lawyers at the FBI and his own DNI, his own Director of National Intelligence, former Senator Coates. And They have counseled President Trump that the release of this memo, which is based on very highly sensitive classified documents, is going to give a false impression of what was going on at the FBI and how decisions were being made. It was an incomplete picture, and it sets a bad precedent for releasing classified information in the public realm.
Is it possible that the FBI director, Christopher Wray, will quit over the release of this, Brian?
Well, I was really interested to see a rare and unusual statement come out of the FBI about the memo, saying they had grave concerns about it being made public. Now, this was a moment – it was an indication that Christopher Wray decided this was a hill he's willing to die on. To allow the department to release that statement. It wasn't released under his name, but it was released as an FBI official statement. And so he has planted a flag here. He's really speaking to his workforce and trying to show that he's standing up for FBI agents. He's not going to let their names be dragged through the mud through what he would consider to be incomplete information. And so it's really created a standoff. It's created a standoff between the White House and the head of the FBI and also the head of the national intelligence agencies.
Well, let's hear a little bit from House Speaker Paul Ryan. This is yesterday, and he actually downplayed the release of the memo.
This memo is not an indictment of the FBI, of the Department of Justice. It does not impugn the Mueller investigation or the Deputy Attorney General.
So, Abby, what do you make of that?
Well, it tells me that Republicans on the Hill, including leadership, are all in on this project, that they are not willing to stand in the way of what Devin Nunes is trying to do here, which by all accounts and by our reporting at CNN and other outlets, the president believes that this is a good way to create doubt in the mind of the public about the objectivity of the Mueller probe. And Paul Ryan's comments really suggest that Republicans are not willing to put the brakes on that. They're okay with this for now, and whatever the consequences are, they have bought into it. And I think that that's a really notable thing. For a long time, Republicans have been kind of tiptoeing around this Mueller investigation, and now they're not anymore. They are on the president's side on this.
Well, and we got a pretty strong statement just this afternoon from John McCain, Senator John McCain, a Republican, who says the latest attacks on the FBI and Department of Justice serve no American interests. No parties, no presidents, only Putin's. The American people deserve to know all the facts surrounding Russia's ongoing efforts to subvert our democracy, which is why Special Counsel Mueller's investigation must proceed unimpeded. Brian, what do you make of that statement from Senator McCain?
I mean, it does show that there's two minds in the Republican Party about how far to go on this and how far to push this. And clearly President Trump is including this in his campaign to discredit the FBI and the Mueller investigation. In fact, President Trump tweeted Friday morning that he had concerns about the politicization of the work of the FBI. And all of this is part of a larger campaign to defend Donald Trump against the Russia investigation.
And I think those voices, like McCain's, are increasingly waning. It seems very much like he is in the minority along with a few other folks. Once you have leadership declining to step in the middle of this and try to mediate this kind of dispute, I think it shows that that's where the majority of the Republicans in the House are, and probably the majority of the Republicans in the Senate as well.
Yeah. Well, former CIA Director John Brennan tweeted yesterday, this is John Brennan again, saying, quote, "I never witnessed the type of reckless partisan behavior I'm now seeing from Nunes and House Republicans. Absence of moral and ethical leadership in White House, WH, is fueling this government crisis." And on this morning, on CBS This Morning, Adam Schiff, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, also criticized Republicans for their support of the memo's release and at the same time withholding the rebuttal from the Democrats.
What they wanted to do was have this misleading document sit out there for at least a week, slow walk the Democratic response so they could hopefully make this the narrative.
Abby, where do we go from here? What do you think happens next now?
Well, you know, it's unclear. I think all eyes right now are not necessarily on the Hill and probably more on the FBI in that building. I mean, I think the big question that we have had all week is, what does the FBI director Christopher Wray do? And what happens to Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general? And I think those are the two principal questions. It's not clear to me that the Democratic memo or any sort of Democratic input at this point matters all that much. I think it's only going to increase the sense in Washington and outside of Washington that this is a partisan food fight. But the turmoil at the FBI is going to break through. If we end up in a situation where we have the FBI director making some kind of public stand about this, that is a red flag in an institution that has been really in turmoil since the very beginning of Donald Trump's presidency. And it seems like we are not anywhere near a kind of stable place with the Department of Justice and the FBI, even though most of these people are President Trump's appointees. He put all these people in their positions, and yet he's still at war with them.
That's Abby Phillip, White House correspondent for CNN. We've also been speaking with Brian Bennett, White House reporter for the LA Times. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks a lot, you guys.
The sales of grass-fed beef have soared in recent years from $17 million worth in 2012 to $272 million in 2016. Grass-fed proponents say raising cattle as much as possible on grass instead of bulking them up with grain leads to beef that's healthier and better for the environment. Yet that grass may be changing in ways that'll affect the future of grass-fed and conventional beef alike. Alex Smith from Harvest Public Media has more.
Surveying the local and national restaurant scenes, Kansas City restaurateur Anton Kotar has concluded that his town's reputation as the country's steakhouse paradise has slipped.
When you're in New York or you're in Miami, they talk about their stuff. They don't talk about, oh, in Kansas City, there's this one.
Kotar says the problem with many steakhouses is the same problem with the beef industry overall. Most beef cattle spend a good part of their lives eating grain or soybeans rather than being raised entirely on grass like they once were. This has made beef cheap and plentiful, and it's changed the flavor we expect from beef. But Kotar thinks it's flooded the market with low-end steaks.
And I think that some of our best steakhouses chased the quality of the beef to the bottom.
If the idea is that grass-fed beef means better steaks, then there's trouble out west. Some scientists are warning that Great Plains grass may be getting less nutritious.
Yeah, so what we have left by now is just this dry, senesced grass.
On a sunny winter day, researcher Joe Crane trots through the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve in central Kansas. From the road, the prairie looks like an unbroken wave of green. But kneeling down, Crane grabs a handful of grasses to show how diverse they actually are, containing hundreds of different species. The prairie is so diverse, in fact, that to study it, Crane and researchers from Texas A&M University don't actually study the plants themselves.
Somewhere on the order of 50,000 cow pies got shipped down to Texas for this study.
Crane studies cow poop that was collected everywhere from Texas to Kansas to Montana between 1994 and 2016. He says he's seen a trend in the quality of the grasses these cattle are eating. Since the mid-90s, levels of crude protein, which cattle need to grow, have dropped by nearly 20%.
If we were still back at the forage quality that we would have had 25 years ago, no less 100 years ago, our animals would be gaining a lot more weight.
Crane suspects rising carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are playing a part in what he's seeing. Increased CO2 levels have been linked to decreasing nutrients in plants like rice, wheat, and potatoes, and he thinks this may be happening on a large scale in the prairie. Crane says it could just be a matter of time before prairie grasses simply don't have enough protein to support grazing.
Pretty soon you're at the point where the protein concentrations are too low for too long a period for the animals to gain any weight.
It is an interesting hypothesis.
Jerry Valesky is a grass researcher with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He uses a different method of measuring health of grasses, and he's skeptical about studying manure for nutritional trends. But he thinks Crane may have a point about rising carbon dioxide. It causes plants to grow bigger, but the amount of nitrogen that makes plants nutritious doesn't change.
Now, on a native rangeland or grassland, nitrogen is the nutrient that is probably most limiting. There just seems to be enough to get by with each year.
Crane says work needs to be done to parse out the causes and effects, but if the trends he's seen continue, beef producers may need to dump huge amounts of nitrogen across the Great Plains if it's going to have the protein needed to raise cattle. A 25-ounce grass-fed bone-in filet sizzles on the grill at Anton's Tap Room. Grass-fed beef is more expensive than conventional beef, but industry analysts say sales of grass-fed beef are up and could make up 30% of the beef market in 10 years. Feeding that demand, however, could be a lot more complicated and expensive if the quality of prairie grass continues to decline. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Smith in Kansas City.
Well, more than 100 million people are expected to tune into the Super Bowl this Sunday. That would make it the ninth consecutive year with such an audience. But analysts don't expect viewership to set any records because the overall trend in NFL ratings has been down. The regular season ratings were off by 10% compared to the year before. Meanwhile, NBA ratings are up about 20% on ESPN and TNT since last season. Kevin Arnovitz is a sports writer for ESPN and joins us now. Hi, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
And what do you think's going on here? What is the NBA doing right that the NFL is doing wrong?
You know, I don't think it's a binary thing. I don't think that the NBA is stealing viewers from the NFL. It's a really complicated landscape right now. I mean, millions of people every year are disconnecting, essentially cutting the cord. Yet live sports is still a really important event. We say the NFL is struggling. Okay, but now Fox paid $3 billion this week to broadcast Thursday Night Football for the next five seasons. That's $60 million a game. So things are relative. I think in the NFL's case, it's a little – there's not a singular factor. Obviously – sports has always been a place where Americans go for escapism, and it might be, and surveys are telling us that the controversies they're finding in the NFL, whether it's protracted arguments over patriotism or concussion in health or criminality.
It's getting too political for people.
Maybe it's too political, too topical. The NBA at the same time has done a really fun job of manufacturing the kind of reality show narratives that bring people to their screens, whichever screens they might be. Just the top players establishing new rivalries, what's going on with the Golden State Warriors the last few years. LeBron is a larger-than-life figure that is magnetic and just draws viewers in. He's more charismatic, I think, you know, than most of the stars in the NFL you can find, and just has that sort of curating. Just the feuds, it's an arena sport, it's intimate, it's character-driven. And I think a lot of that's happening. I think it's also important to note, Jeremy, we are dealing with microclimates, right? There are 30 teams, and so you have teams, regional coverage is up, my sources tell me, about 9% on this sort of nightly regional sports networks that carry NBA teams. But, you know, and they're down in Phoenix, which is struggling, but they're up in Minnesota, which is a team that's improved a lot this season. So, I mean, I do think all of this is relative, and you have to deal with the sort of microclimates. But the NFL is having some topical issues that the NBA is not.
Well, you say that there are 30 teams in the NBA, but they play 82 games a season, whereas in the NFL, you've got 32 teams that only play 16 games. The NFL averaged 15 million viewers a game during the regular season. NBA viewership is around 2 million, but again, a lot more games.
Right. And by the way, those are national numbers, too, for the NBA. I mean, the NFL does not have local broadcast, whereas the NBA does, right? Like, you see your national games. There are a few each week on ESPN, who's my employer, on Turner, on NBA TV. But the vast majority of NBA games are broadcasted on Fox Sports Northwest or Fox Sports Oklahoma. We are measuring apples and oranges when we measure professional football in this country, which, as you say, is a scarce product. Every game is playoff implications and a national holiday every Sunday and every Thursday night and every Monday night. In the NBA, which has far, in my opinion, too many games, does get a nice crowd for their big marquee events and is doing much better in those. But it is two different products.
Well, you mentioned that people may feel that the NFL is getting too political with this public fight between President Trump and the players who kneel during the national anthem. I do remember, though, that NBA players, including LeBron James, have also sparred with the president on Twitter. James called the president a bum. So that hasn't had that kind of effect?
No, I mean, it hasn't. I do think the issues brought up by Kaepernick were of much greater magnitude in terms of the public imagination. I mean, yeah, there was some sparring in the press between Steph Curry and LeBron James and Donald Trump. I don't think we're talking about the anthem or even Trump versus athletes. I think it's an overall mood of escapism. Is this a product that a sports fan can go and lose him or herself for 2.5, 3, 3.5 hours, however long it is, and it's an entertainment product? Or does it have kind of the shroud of politics and the topical conversations you kind of want to get away from, that you're tired from the office? And again, I'm not somebody who's administered these surveys. By the way, don't discount on the NFL, Jeremy. The Dallas Cowboys had an off season. The Seattle Seahawks had an off season. The Green Bay Packers had an off season. Don't underestimate the value of the marquee tentpole teams in any league to drive viewerships. So I don't think it's a coincidence on a year where it was a small market like Jacksonville, which doesn't have any recognizable stars, versus Dallas, Green Bay, Seattle, the teams that casual fans get accustomed to seeing when the snow hits the ground and they tune in for casual viewership.
There's always Tom Brady, though.
There is always Tom Brady. He is ubiquitous. He is inextinguishable, yes.
What about overseas? You know, the NFL has famously tried to have these games in London, but the NBA is very popular around the world.
It is really popular around the world. China, obviously, is a satellite for the NBA. They've poured a lot of resources in terms of academies, trying to harvest talent out of there. Obviously, I mean, distribution of your sport on television in China is always an interesting challenge, but the NBA's poured a lot into it. Stars like Kobe Bryant, recently retired in the last couple of seasons, have huge footprints over there among the commercial audience. It's a game that's very popular globally. It is not soccer by any stretch, but it's getting to establish itself as a very close, I wouldn't say a close number two, but a number two within screaming distance.
Hmm. So if you were to give advice to the NFL, let's say that they have their Super Bowl ratings come out and they're down 5 to 10% from last year, what would you tell them? Is there something they can learn from the NBA?
I still think this is a celebrity culture, and they need to do a better job of manufacturing superstars who just connect, who between games on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, people want to hear from. I think it's very much about what is going on between the actual three-hour games. Who are the magnetic superstars of the NFL right now? There aren't as many as there should be.
That's Kevin Arnovitz, sports writer for ESPN. Kevin, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
For millions of women who get mammograms in the U.S. every year, they could have a new kind of choice when they arrive at the doctor's office. I'm talking about the difference between getting a traditional screening or maybe getting a so-called 3D mammogram. A number of studies have found that this technology is more accurate at detecting cancer, but the long-term differences are still unclear. Michelle Andrews is a contributing columnist at Kaiser Health News. Hi there, Michelle.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Well, first of all, just quickly explain to us sort of the functional differences or the technological differences between 2D and 3D mammograms.
Well, women typically get a 2D mammogram, and that 2D stands for two-dimensional. It usually is a front image and a side image in the machine that, you know, presses your breast between those two plates. All women know what that that's like. While a 3D image is the same kind of feel for women, but instead of just getting that front and side view, it actually, the X-ray arcs across your breast and gets a lot of different slices so that it can see many different angles and different images of your breast.
Does that make it more accurate, or can then doctors sort of view more deeply into the breast tissue because of this?
It typically shows is more sensitive is how they describe it.
Okay.
And so, yes, it does pick up more. That's certainly true.
And so pick up more meaning down to the, like, what does that mean? Like, is it resolution or what?
It'll pick up more lesions, more abnormalities. And it also allows technicians to view the breast without overlapping tissues, which can sometimes be a problem with a standard 2D mammogram.
Okay, so I guess the overall hope then there is better and more accurate diagnoses. But are there downsides to this 3D technology?
There are some concerns, yes. First of all, it's pricier, and you may have to pay for it out of pocket because not all insurers cover it. it can cost about $50 extra, although some states do require it. So that's uncertain, but you'd want to check. While it will pick up more, as I said, abnormalities, mm-hmm. we don't necessarily know if those are abnormalities that are problematic. And so there is a risk of overdiagnosis in those cases, of course. You know, if you go looking for something, you may find it, but we don't have such a great ability at this time to know whether something is going to be a bad cancer down the road or cause you problems down the road. So you might get unnecessary testing and procedures. The other thing is that there is more radiation in many cases with this 3D test, because typically you get both a 2D and a 3D image when you get your 3D. Sometimes that's done with technology, with software, but sometimes they actually take two separate X-ray shots, and then you get twice the radiation. So that's something that you'd want to check before you go ahead with it.
I see. Well, overall, are we likely to see doctors more often use these 3D systems?
We're certainly seeing an increase in their availability. There are about 30% more of them now available in imaging centers, and that's just an increase in 1 year. So, yes, I think it's very much likely that women are going to be offered this test more frequently.
Wow. Well, Michelle Andrews is a contributing columnist at Kaiser Health News. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The longest war in U.S. history has gotten more deadly over the last month. Recent attacks in Afghanistan have left hundreds dead. They're being blamed on the Taliban and ISIS. But Afghan officials said this week that the attackers were trained in Pakistan, where Taliban leaders roam free. President Trump made similar claims and announced last month that he's cutting off all security aid to Pakistan. Aziz Ahmad Chowdhury is Pakistan's ambassador to the United States. He joins us now from his office in Washington. Ambassador Chowdhury, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I want to start with this spate of deadly attacks in Afghanistan that has left more than 200 people dead in the last month. A lot of people pointing the finger at Pakistan. Is that fair?
Well, we condemn those attacks. The innocent lives have been lost. Our foreign minister was in Afghan embassy in Islamabad, and we commiserate with the people and government of Afghanistan. But we also would like to express our disappointment that anything that happens in Afghanistan, no matter what, the only reaction that we hear from Kabul is to blame Pakistan. And I think externalizing your own problems will not help that government deal with the issue at hand.
So you do not think that that's true, that Pakistan bears some blame here?
Absolutely not. Pakistan does not want any violence or terrorism in Afghanistan. In fact, we have suffered from the instability in Afghanistan. We are the only country that will benefit the most, apart from the people of Afghanistan, if peace returns to Afghanistan. Why would we support any element that would destabilize Afghanistan and in turn bring that instability to Pakistan?
Do you think that the Taliban should give up its fight in Afghanistan? Are you willing to go that far? Would Pakistan want that?
Absolutely. I think our message to Taliban is very, very clear. Violence and terrorism under any pretext is not acceptable. They must go to Afghanistan and join the political mainstream.
Now, you say the Afghan officials are unfairly criticizing Pakistan, but it's not just Afghanistan. The NATO Secretary General said Taliban bases in Pakistan pose a big challenge to peace in the region. And of course, President Trump and other U.S. officials say Pakistan has given safe haven to terrorists, including the Taliban and the Haqqani network.
Well, I was referring to the knee-jerk reaction in Kabul to blame everything on Pakistan. Afghanistan is a major complex problem now. There are so many aspects of it. There are governance issues. There are corruption issues. There is a booming drug trade. And therefore, we have been saying that instead of blaming us, I think work with Pakistan. Pakistan wants to help. It gives the impression to us as if Pakistan is being scapegoated for the failures in Afghanistan. In Pakistan, there's a big contrast between the situation in Pakistan and situation in Afghanistan in the last 3 years. If you see the last 3 years in Pakistan, the terrorists are on the run and the law and order situation has improved in Pakistan. Economy is booming. Whereas in Afghanistan, exactly the opposite has happened. And to the best of my information, bulk of the Afghan leadership, which is Taliban and Haqqani leadership, are now in Afghanistan. Why would they stay in Pakistan, where Pakistan is breathing down their neck?
So you say work with us. What do you think the solution is to the violence in Afghanistan?
I think the solution is to have a comprehensive political approach and engage in a genuine political dialogue between
with
all Afghan
Taliban
factions. We don't want to be party to it. We think that it should be between Afghan government and all Afghan factions. The Taliban must be made to be part of that process. We tried it twice, Jeremy. We did it once in 2015. The second time, the four nations, Pakistan, Afghanistan, United States, and China, came together. And in May, when we set out to meet all the Taliban, all of us, four, to persuade them that they must give up violence, the Taliban leader was killed in a drone strike. So I think the Taliban are not ready to listen to Pakistan. Our influence on them has eroded, because twice we brought them with whatever influence we had, and now they are leaving our country, and we have that much less influence on them.
As you know, Mr. Ambassador, in his first tweet of the year, President Trump wrote, "The United States has foolishly given Pakistan more than $33 billion in aid over the last 15 years, and they have given us nothing but lies and deceit." What is the state right now of Pakistan's relationship with the Trump administration, which you're on the front lines of?
Well, we would like to have good relations with the United States. There's no doubt about it. The two countries have worked together for seven decades, and we think that it would be a mistake to squander that relationship. Both countries have benefited from that relationship, and if that relationship goes down, I think both countries are going to lose. The tweet, it was received with great disappointment, because Pakistan and United States have worked together for such a long time, and to, you know, measure it only in terms of dollars and cents was an unfair treatment. And surprised, because we were already having conversations with the U.S. Secretary Mattis was in Pakistan, earlier Secretary Tillerson was in Pakistan. We were having those conversations. The idea was to use the words of Secretary Mattis, find that common ground where two countries have to work. I think the direction should be to find common grounds and not engage in any coercive or disrespectful relationship. Pakistan believes in a relationship which should be based on mutual respect and mutual trust, and I think that's where the future should lie.
But if the Trump administration is going to withhold this $2 billion in military assistance, do you expect Pakistan to just go to China and Russia to get what it needs?
Well, first of all, we challenge these figures. I don't know where these figures have come from. There is a component called CSF, which is a reimbursement of the expenses that Pakistan had made in pursuit of shared objectives of countering terrorism. And that money has been held $1 billion or so in the last 2-3 years. And I think that is payable to Pakistan, but that has been withheld. The second is the security cooperation, which if United States does not want, then of course there'll be other options that Pakistan will be approaching to.
Do you think there would be any strings attached with those other options if you are to form a stronger relationship, let's say, with China?
Well, we believe that no relationship should be like a transaction, like a commercial relationship. I think it's when you have relationships, they should be based on a commonality of objectives, on points of convergence rather than points of divergence, or as if you pay something and you get something. I don't think it is a mercantile relationship.
But some people would look at China's relationship with Pakistan and say it is exactly that. There are reports in the Chinese media that China is planning to build a naval base near a strategic Pakistani port. And there's also the China-Pakistan corridor, the railway network, which is currently under construction.
There is no China naval base on or off Pakistan's shores. That is absolutely not correct. Gwadar port is a commercial port, and it will serve to connect Western China with Pakistan. And along the route, there'll be special economic zones. We have invested hugely in infrastructure and energy. Our energy deficits are gone. Our infrastructure is building. And now our economy will be booming. And let me tell you, a number of companies from all across the world, not just China, but from Turkey and Europe and Korea and also corporate America, are going there in Pakistan to reap from the economic bonanza that is going to happen, inshallah, there.
I want to ask you about one more thing, and that is, of course, India. Do you see a moment right now when Pakistan and India can start having serious talks about things beyond Kashmir?
I think there is no other way but for India and Pakistan to talk and resolve their issues peacefully. India has not been talking to Pakistan. Every time Pakistan and India come together, some militants come forward and do bad things, and India suspends the dialogue. And I tell my Indian friends, look, you are doing exactly what these militants want to do, which is to separate us, to push us away from each other. We are neighbors. We need good neighborly relationship, and therefore we should actually continue to talk and continue to cooperate to squeeze the space for these militants and isolate them. But India somehow is not fully convinced of that, and therefore they have suspended all dialogue with Pakistan.
Are you concerned at all that India's leader, Narendra Modi, seems to have a pretty good relationship with President Trump?
Well, India and the United States are two independent countries. They are free to make whatever relationship they want to have. But of course, I think U.S. leaning towards India is, it should not be at the expense of Pakistan, nor should it embolden the Indian government to take any aggressive measures against Pakistan.
That's Aizaz Ahmad Chowdhury, who is the Pakistani ambassador to the United States. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us.
Sir, thank you very much for having me.
This is Here and Now. Netflix debuted a new sci-fi drama today called Altered Carbon. It joins CBS's reboot of Star Trek, HBO's Westworld, and others in an increasingly crowded sci-fi landscape on TV. Altered Carbon is set in the far future in a society where people can transfer their consciousness from one body to another.
Your body is not who you are. You shed it like a snake sheds its skin.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Well, let's hear a little more from the show. This is the protagonist, played by Joel Kinnaman, wakes up to a hologram which conveniently for the first episode offers some exposition.
This is a cortical stack. As protectorate citizens, we each have one, implanted when we are 1 year old. Inside is pure human mind, coded and stored as DHF. Digital human freight. Your consciousness can be downloaded into any stack in any sleeve. A sleeve is replaceable, but if your stack is destroyed, you die. There's no coming back from real death.
Eric, how does this premise play out in the series?
Oh my God, it's so complicated. But basically, okay, so they're able to store your consciousness digitally and in this little disc, and this disc can be slipped into different bodies, which they call sleeves. And so as far as the story goes, Joel Kinnaman plays this sort of super soldier known as an envoy who was on ice for 250 years for trying to overthrow the system of government that exists. And he gets brought out of stasis and put in a new body because this wealthy person believes that someone tried to kill him. This guy, his consciousness is backed up every 2 days. And someone killed him right before the backup was supposed to happen. And now he's brought Joel Kinnaman's character out of stasis to try and figure out what happened and try and figure out who might have killed him. And we have a little scene. Let's check it out.
So your current self has no memory of what happened?
Well, whoever killed me pulled the trigger 10 minutes before my backup went through.
Which means all of your memories from those 48 hours are gone.
Completely. There was an attempted hack on my satellite feed moments after my death. Somebody wants me dead.
For all I know, you did try to kill yourself. You just botched the job.
Mr. Kovac, I am not the kind of man who would take his own life.
Intriguing, Eric. But does this show, do you think, stand out from all the other sci-fi shows out there right now?
Well, it's interesting. This is a show that kind of wears its influences on its sleeve. So when you look at it, you can tell that sort of the visual look of it is borrowed from films like Blade Runner. The class conflict where you have all these wealthy people who live forever, and then you have poor people who are sort of ground under the heel of this technology. That also reminds you of Blade Runner and maybe a film that Matt Damon did called Elysium, if you remember that from 2013. Mm-hmm. The idea of switching bodies, we saw that in Ghost in the Shell. Shell, if you remember that sort of high-tech movie with Scarlett Johansson. So I think that's the unsatisfying thing about this show, is that it wears its influences on its sleeve and it doesn't really manage to say much that's very new. It's very violent. It's very explicit. But, you know, I was thinking in that little scene that we heard, you know, if your consciousness is backed up somewhere else, what's really you? You know, are you sitting in a hard drive somewhere, or are you the person who's walking around, you know, talking to other people? And the show doesn't really play around with those kinds of ideas, but I think those ideas are some of the most interesting ones that it actually raises.
Eric, while we're talking about sci-fi shows, I have to ask you about the one that I keep hearing about, everybody tells me to watch, which is the Netflix show Black Mirror.
Okay, now there is no excuse if you haven't watched it by now.
There's so much TV
what you're doing right
now. Yeah.
Pick up your iPad and start watching Black Mirror right now. This Black Mirror is I think it's a great example. Number one, it's a great example of an anthology TV show that works really well. It's in the way that The Twilight Zone might offer a new story every episode, Black Mirror does that too, except it's centered on technology and society and how technology affects us. And so the latest, you know, the fourth season dropped on Netflix at the end of December, and it was another batch of really great episodes. There's an episode called Archangel, directed by Jodie Foster, where there's technology that you can put an implant in your child's head, and then you can use an iPad to see through their eyes and even block disturbing images from their sight by remote. And then what happens when that child grows up, but they still have a parent who still has access to that technology, you know? There's another episode called the USS Callister, where a socially inept designer creates a virtual reality world that's this it's a version of a video game, but it's based on sort of a Star Trekian kind of universe. And it turns out it's people with all these people that abuse him at work, but he can create versions of them in this world where he gets to be the abuser. And so what happens when you get trapped in these kind of virtual worlds where all you're doing is living out fantasies instead of existing in the real world? You know, Black Mirror asks a lot of these questions about how technology affects us. I think it does it in a much more effective way than Altered Carbon.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you.
Always a pleasure.